From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. J. Randy Tarabarelli returns this week. He's the author of many, many fine biographies, including books about Diana Ross, Madonna, Cher, Elizabeth Taylor, Michael Jackson, and many others. And I'm always excited when he writes another book because it means I'll get a chance to have another conversation with him. In fact, it's been almost 20 years of conversations. Many of J. Randy Tarabarelli's books have been about the Kennedy clan, including his newest, JFK, Public, Private, Secret. J. Randy Tarabarelli, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Good to be back. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Randy, before we talk about your new book, let's take a minute or two to talk about some of your previous subjects, because I know you're not like some biographers. You don't lose interest in a figure that you've written about. You like to keep up with them. And in fact, you recently updated your Madonna book, for instance. I saw her in concert recently. Did you catch her last tour? Did you have any thoughts?
No, I did not. How was it?
Well, I thought maybe she might be past her prime.
Oh, okay.
I was sort of surprised because every time I've seen her in the past, she's so full of energy, but she kind of ran out of steam about halfway through.
Mm-hmm. Well, it happens, man. I ran out of steam 5 years ago, and I'm still going on.
I can't afford to see Beyonce, but have you been keeping up with her?
No, I really haven't, man. Once I write about them, for the most part, then I, with the exception of the Kennedys, I leave them behind. I did update Madonna.
Yeah.
But Beyonce was a fantastic experience for me, and I loved every moment of it. But once it was over, I moved on to Jackie, Janet, and Lee.
Yeah.
Jackie and her mom and her sister. And I don't have time to keep up with what's going on outside of whatever the world is that I'm immersed in during the time of my book. When I was working on JFK, all I cared about was the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Berlin Wall and, the Bay of Pigs and Castro and Khrushchev and, That's in Vietnam. That's a lot, So yeah. I don't have really much time to do anything else.
Well, do you think you will write about show business again? I was thinking Taylor Swift would be a topic.
No, it's not for me. Beyonce was not a success for me.
No.
In fact, Beyonce was my least successful book of my entire career.
Maybe it was too early. She wasn't quite as famous then as she is now.
No, it was 10 years ago and she was pretty famous.
Yeah.
I think it's because that's a generation that really doesn't read books. and they're used to getting their information about their favorite celebrities on Instagram and quick bites without having to sit down and read a gigantic Randy Tarabarelli tome of 500 pages about Beyonce. I'll tell you, I thought it was going to sell. I mean, that's why we did it, because I had written Call Her Miss Ross a long time ago, but it was one of my biggest books. And my publisher said, well, Beyonce from the author of Call Her Miss Ross is a natural fit, that should work. But man, it did not work. It didn't sell at all. And that was really a lesson for me that it can't be about the current fad. For me, it has to be about some kind of an historical topic that is bigger than the moment.
So you think you'll stick with that?
And that's why I'm focusing on the Kennedys, because they are bigger than the moment and they don't go out of style ever.
I once asked you why you write about strong women like Cher and Elizabeth Taylor and Madonna. And you said you thought it was because women read more books than men, which I thought was a great answer. But I wonder, do you think that's still true? Do you think more when you go on your book tours and hear from your fans, are they mainly women? Or
I don't know. I can't say. I can only say that I think women read my books more, more than men.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's generally true across the board. But, I've been writing about women and my audience is female as a result of that. But I don't know that I'm only going to have a female audience for this book, for JFK.
Right.
I think it's going to be more wider than a female audience. At least I hope so. But you know, you can't even write for your audience. You know, I mean, I don't think about that very much when I'm writing a book. I only think about, to be honest with you, I only think about myself.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking about what is the story that I'm telling that entertains me, keeps me interested, is something that I want to know about, maybe something I don't know about that I need to learn. You know, it's really kind of me until it gets out there into the world, and then you just have to hope that other people feel the same way. And I'll tell you, you know, when I find that on this particular book tour, I'm really kind of fascinated by the fact that people are telling me, you know, I didn't know about the Cuban Missile Crisis. I didn't know about the Bay of Pigs. I didn't know about the Berlin Wall. I mean, you know, you hear these things in passing, but you never do a deep dive into them. And what I tried to do with this book was give you a real primer for that time and place in history, so that if you want to know about the Cuban Missile Crisis and you don't want to have to pick up a book that's that thick about the Cuban Missile Crisis, right? And there are entire books about the Cuban Missile Crisis. You just want to kind of get in there and dip in and kind of figure it out without being overwhelmed. That's what this book will do for you. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted, you know, I wanted to give people a chance to learn about Vietnam and Castro and all of these many amazing historical touchstones without being bogged down in history. And I think I did that. I mean, every chapter was designed with an eye toward how much do I want to know about this? And if I got to a point where it was too much for me, then I knew it was going to be too much for my reader, and I would cut it back.
I'm surprised to hear you say this, because I thought that your main motivation was, what book will Gary Shapiro want to read next? Because all your books are books that I want to read. Oh, I was thinking
about that, but I decided I better not have that be my mandate. But I do think about it often.
Glad to hear it. Another person that you wrote about in the past and is related to this, has been in the news of late. You wrote a great book 5 or 6 years ago in this Kennedy realm, The Kennedy Heirs, John Carolyn and a New Generation, A Legacy and Triumph of Triumph and Tragedy. And Robert Kennedy Jr. Was among that generation of Kennedys that you wrote about. He's currently, I don't know if you're aware, he's currently the United States Secretary of Health and Human Services.
No, that can't be true. Is that true? Oh, I can't believe that. Wow, when did that happen?
Do you have any thoughts about how does he fit in with the Kennedy legacy nowadays?
Not well. Yeah. You know, the family, for the most part, is unhappy with him. And I think with, you know, good reason. You know, he seems to have gone off the rails, and I don't know why. But I do know that I've interviewed him in the past, and he was great. What people don't know is that he was really the chosen one. Like, they really thought he was going to be the next president. And in the same way that they thought Ted was going to be the next president, you know, right after JFK, in the same way that the burden was lifted from Ted and it allowed him to be free to live his life without that weight. That's what happened with Bobby. When he finally made it clear that he was not presidential material 30 years ago, then he became an environmental lawyer and he began to really live a good life. And make a big difference too, as an environmental lawyer. I mean, he made a big difference. So it's surprising that he decided that he wanted to be president, you know, at his age now, when it was something he never wanted before. And he fought it tooth and nail his entire youth into his early 20s and into his 30s. He just did not want that. Then he changed his mind and then he did. And, And when it wasn't happening, then he wanted to align himself with one of the two parties. And I think I would have more respect for his mission if he had made a decision to align with a particular party for a particular reason. But instead, he went to both parties and to see which one would have him.
Yeah.
And that, to me, doesn't really speak to any kind of ideology as much as it just speaks to, I want to be doing something with some president somewhere, right?
Yeah.
And Kamala Harris didn't want him. And so Donald Trump did. I mean, if Kamala Harris had wanted him, then he would have gone there, you know? And I think that that's one of the reasons why his family takes issue with him, is because he wasn't really demonstrating, you know, a mandate of a moral compass as much as he was demonstrating a need to attach to one of the two, whichever one would have him. And that's kind of disappointing.
Well, Carolyn Kennedy, who doesn't usually talk about this kind of thing, was very verbal in her opposition to him. Did that surprise you?
It did surprise me because she's not that public a person. You know, she's much like her mom, and she doesn't like to make those kinds of statements. But she must have felt very strongly about it for her to have put herself out there like that, because she really did.
Yeah.
And the rest of the family did too, you know, and they were really, you know, sort of adamant that this was a really bad decision and that he wasn't the right guy, you know? So, you know, what can I say? it's a difficult thing, and I don't know what to make of it.
Well, you know, you've written a lot about political figures, but your books are not particularly political. And is this because you personally have absolutely no political opinions? You've never voted.
You don't. Oh no, I have a good one. And I have many. And if you read any of my social media, you'll know that.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm pretty out there. But it's just that I don't really feel like I want to insert that into my books.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's not fair, really, to the reader, for them to come to a book and get all of my opinions. But I will say, though, that a book is not just a recitation of the facts. It's my interpretation of them. And in my interpretation, you're going to find my opinion,
uh-huh.
You know. And, I mean, that's just the way it is. You know, people often think a book is just the facts, and it's not. That's a Wikipedia entry. You know, if you want the facts, go to Wikipedia. And even then, you're not going to get them completely accurately, right?
Yeah.
And so I really feel like a book is the circumstances and then my kind of interpretation of them and what I make of them. I think that people want that from me as the biographer. They want to know, what do you think of it? And if they agree with me, fine. And if they don't, they don't. But that's the chance you take when you pick up a book. Either you're going to agree with the point of view or you're not, but that doesn't mean that it's wrong or you're wrong. Hopefully what it means is conversation between you and your friends about that issue.
Well, I was not a fan of the Bushes, but I enjoyed your Bush book quite a bit. It was an excellent book.
I loved writing that book, and I was not a fan either. You know, not at all, but I thought it was a really good book, and I loved every second of writing that book. I thought that they were really compelling people, and I thought that they all had good hearts. You know, I think that George Bush did a lot of the wrong things for the right reasons, you know, and I thought they were great. And I loved Laura Bush. I loved all of those people. And I interviewed Barbara Bush way back. I got to meet George W. and that was great. He was a great guy. And I mean, I remember thinking when I was with them, wow, I sure hated you as a president, but I love you as a guy.
Well, his presidency looks a lot better when you compare it to.
Oh, man. Now George Bush is like, we won't do anything to get George Bush back, right?
That's right.
I mean, he does owe Donald Trump a debt of gratitude because Donald Trump has kind of changed people's view of George Bush, you know, but. As I write about in social media, this is a time and place, and there have been many times and places, you know, and the 60s had its own uprising. And what we're seeing today with, you know, immigration and deportation, a lot of that we saw in the 60s with civil rights. And there are people who didn't believe that there should be civil rights. Is it just as there are people who are opposed, you know, to this kind of mass deportation today and people who love it, you know, so we're always going to be at odds in this country. And I think the important thing for people to remember is that time goes on. And if you like Donald Trump, more power to you. And if you don't, just hang on, he'll be gone, you know, and this time he won't be back. Right. So I just think that perspective is important. And if you read enough history books, you realize that we've always had important issues. I mean, there was nothing. I mean, the 1960s were really chaos, you know, and Vietnam and civil rights and women's lib and assassinations, Martin Luther King, JFK, Bobby Kennedy. You know, there was a, compared to then, I think today is a kind of a cakewalk.
Yeah. Well, I was a little disappointed that George W. Bush didn't come out one way or another on Trump's candidacy in his second run. He said something like he's retired from politics. And I thought, do presidents ever – has any president like that ever said, I'm retired from politics?
George is like – Most of presidents. I mean, even Barack Obama has not been as forceful as you would like, you know, in that regard. But the custom is that presidents don't criticize other presidents. That's the custom. Just that with Donald Trump, everything goes out the window, right. You know, but some things don't. And these elder statesmen who have, you know, who believe in a certain way and believe that the country expects a certain thing from them, they're going to give the country that. And no greater proof of that is Joe Biden sitting down with Donald Trump in the Oval Office in front of a roaring fireplace to welcome him back after spending a year telling us that Trump was a threat to democracy and that it was the worst thing that could ever happen. And then for him to just say, welcome back, shake his hand, you know, I mean, and, you know, and he did it because the peaceful transfer of power is important and it's what we expect. But I will say Donald Trump didn't do it for him.
That's right.
You know, so many people, and me included, felt that Biden shouldn't have done that, that it just made him look weak. But Biden and people of that generation and elder statesmen like Biden and Bush, and now Obama is coming up in those ranks, Clinton, you know, they believe in the American way. I'm not sure that Donald Trump believes in the American way as much as he just believes in Donald Trump. But these guys believe in the American way. I mean, there's a President's Club. I always wanted to write a book called The President's Club, you know, where these guys actually, you know, commiserate with each other. You don't see any of these guys commiserating with Donald Trump about anything. You know, Donald Trump doesn't want to know them and they don't want to know him. That's the fact. But Obama and Clinton and Bush, you know, these guys, and Biden, they have like this club, you know, where they call each other and they talk to each other about important issues. And what do you think? And how do you feel? You know, none of them are calling Donald Trump to ask him how he feels, right? You know, so we're living in a different world right now, but I think it's a temporary world. And I think that after Trump is gone, we'll go back to a different way, which will be the other way, the way that we're used to. I think this is historically in time and place, this is going to be looked at as an anomaly. And I think that it's going to be very different in 4 years.
Well, let's hope so. Do you think the first ladies also have a sort of a club?
I do, and Melania's not in it, you know, and she's not, you know. I mean, I know that, you know, that first ladies do communicate with each other and do stay in touch with each other, and how can Melania be a part of that club when her husband's not a part of the other club, you know? And Look, they're outsiders. Look, the whole reason that they're even in government is because they're perceived as outsiders, right? That's how they position themselves. But deep down inside, I know I've been writing about these kinds of people for my entire life. I know these kinds of people, these public figures, and I know how much they want to be loved. And you know that it kills Melania Trump and it kills Donald Trump deep down inside, where we'll never be able to access, that these people don't want anything to do with them. I mean, I know it does, because I know people, I know human nature, I know powerful people. They're very, very sensitive. And if Donald Trump could change things, I think what he would love to do is call Barack Obama and say, "What's up?" But he can't do that because of the positions that he's taken over the years,
yeah.
You know, which are the positions that have got him elected. And that's just the price you pay, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're talking with J. Randy Tarabarelli, and his new book is called JFK, Public, Private, Secret. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. You sort of have a Rashomon thing going with your new book, because your last book was called Jackie, Public, Private, Secret. And I remember when we were talking about that book, how you had certain scenes that have been in so many JFK biographies, and you found a new way of talking about them. And that book had a sort of a different range, because you carried Jackie's life, which was considerably longer. But talk a little bit about this new book and how you came up with the idea of this one. You said you'd never written a straight ahead JFK biography before.
No, this is my first. You know, after Jackie, Public, Private, Secret was a success, I just felt like the time had come to tell his side of the story, because I had written about him through Jackie's eyes in so many other books. I felt like I wanted him to have his own place in the narrative. I didn't want it to be a defense of JFK as much as I wanted it to be an explanation. I was on Good Morning America. I was on Good Morning America the other day, and they said that the book is not a tell-all, it's an explain-all. And I thought that was really an interesting way of putting it, because that's really what I set out to do. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to defend him, but I wanted to explain him. And I think that, well, you know, what I found was a real journey of sort of this man who came into power with no empathy and no, he was blocked. His emotions were really blocked. He was raised to not express emotion and to kind of keep everything bottled up. And in that respect, Jackie had her work cut out for her in trying to get this guy to open up and be a husband, you know, and he was unfaithful to her, and she really had her trouble with him. But you'll see that during the course of their marriage, a bunch of important things happened, which I won't outline here, but I will say it. Some real crucible moments occurred that caused him to evaluate and reevaluate and open up his heart and become a very different person. And as he began to take accountability to her for his mistakes in their marriage, he was also taking accountability to the American public for some mistakes he had made in his presidency. And, you know, I think accountability is what we want in our leaders. And I think you can't do that, and you can't be a good leader until you're a good man. And JFK was becoming both at the time of his death. And I think that that's the tragedy here, is that we can't imagine what was ahead for him, but I think it was going to be very good.
Well, of course, that's, you know, a question we've been talking about for 60 some years, right? But you have some, I really enjoyed the book, by the way, and there's so many details in it. And I'm wondering, you know, you had FBI files and FBI tapes. Is this the first time those tapes have been accessed for this kind of book?
I think so, you know, but I've been accessing FBI files, I don't know, 25 years now. And one thing I've learned about the FBI files is that you really got to approach him with a grain of salt. Because here's the thing that people don't know about the FBI files. Any crackpot can call the FBI with a story about any public person. And that story is filed away in the files as if it's been vetted, when actually all it's been is called in. And it's given the same weight as a legitimate story. So in other words, it's up to the person reading the FBI files to determine, okay, does this matter or is this just some nut job? And if you're the kind of person who loves nut jobs and traffics in nut jobs and in conspiracy theories, then you're going to approach the FBI files from that vantage point. And if you're the kind of person who's not looking for that, then you're going to approach them the way I do, which is that I take them all with a grain of salt. And I think that people, they feel that because it's in the FBI files, right? And believe me, I've looked at, I'll bet 100,000 FBI files over the last 25 years. And there's stuff in there that you cannot believe ever happened. But, you know, it's there and it has the same weight of things that really did happen. And it's not like there are two different versions. It's not like here's a file of stuff that didn't happen and here's a file of stuff that did. They're all merged together under one topic, Marilyn Monroe, right? And then you're going through them and here you got Marilyn doing this and you got Marilyn doing that. And this one is based on some person who called in, and this one's based on someone who saw her somewhere. And it's just a big mess, man. And you really can, like, you really have to just use it as supplemental material. I use it as a way to find leads into stories, because sometimes those people, those crackpots know other people who might not be crackpots. And you might actually end up with somebody, but for the most part, You can't take them seriously. You really can't.
Well, I know when you listen to a tape of people talking, it's different than reading a transcript of them talking. And you quote some FBI transcripts of wiretaps and so on with JFK. Did you actually hear them, or you can only read the transcripts of them?
No, I just had the transcripts, you know. But we know, at least we know for sure that, you know, Inga was being followed and that the FBI was, you know, tracing her and that they were filing reports. And that I believe, because I know that story, you know, and you have
talking
this
here. You're talking here about
JFK.
I wouldn't believe it.
I'll tell you the truth. If that's all I had, I'm not sure how much I would believe.
Talking about Inga, JFK's first girlfriend, right?
Yeah, his first girlfriend, Inga Arvid. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we had her family and, you know, we had her sons and we had, you know, people testifying to what she said. And we had her letters from the JFK library and we had his letters to her. And we had, you know, we had so much material that the FBI files made sense. But if we didn't have all that, I'm not even sure I would have used these files. You need more than the files. You need the backup material.
Corroboration.
Yeah.
Well, that was a pretty interesting story, though. I mean, how do you think that love affair, a failed love affair, obviously, since he married Jacqueline Kennedy, how do you think that love affair affected President Kennedy's future?
Well, you know, he never got over it. And he was 24. It was his first love. And I think that, you know, we often don't get over our first love, right? And especially if it ends in a 6-month period when passion is really strong, before you have a chance to mess it up, right? Before you have a chance to really get to know the other person and before reality sets in, because I think that there's a 6-month period in every relationship where, you know, this person is the sun of the moon and you're crazy about that person and that person has no faults. And then that kind of wears off in the real world. And then that's when you have a real relationship, when you start to see all of that break down. But if you end the relationship in that 6 month period, then you will be forevermore romanticizing that relationship in maybe in an unreal way, right? Because it's aborted before it has a chance to show its flaws. And that's what happened with JFK and Inga. It ended at the 6 month mark. And he really had a hard time getting over it. And as you read in the book, he kept going back. You know, he even went back after PT-109, you know, to try to win her back, and knocked on her door and her fiance answered, you know. So, I mean, he was really trying. He even invited her to his wedding, to Jackie, you know, which, I mean, I don't know how he thought that was going to work out. She didn't go, but he did, you know, plan to invite her. So I think it was a really, really important relationship. And it says a lot because of all the letters back and forth between the two of them. And there are no letters back and forth between JFK and Jackie. Really? There's so much in the Kennedy Library between Inga and JFK, so much handwritten forever. And with JFK, Jackie, there's one postcard. You hope to see you soon. Something like that. You know,
yeah.
So it just shows you the different level of investment that he had in Inga from what he had with Jackie.
Well, he always had, and this is something I learned in your book, his eye on the presidency, even when he was a young man. And is his marriage to Jacqueline Kennedy a romantic one or a career serving one?
It was career serving at the beginning. You know, he needed to marry because he needed a wife. He was in his 30s and the father wanted him to become a president one day, and that wasn't going to happen if he didn't have a first lady. And she needed to marry because she needed to marry. Her mom wanted to get her settled, they called it back then, which meant wife and children. Mm-hmm. Husband and children.
Right.
And when JFK proposed, Janet, the mom, asked Jackie, "Do you love him?" And Jackie's response was, "I enjoy him." Right. Which isn't really quite the same thing. But I mean, JFK called it an arranged marriage, and it really was. They didn't have a lot in common. And as I wrote in the book, today, they would decide that there was a lack of chemistry and they would break up. But back then there were a lot of people pushing them together and they did end up together, you know, but they didn't have a foundation of love. And that made what was about to occur tougher because under ordinary circumstances, they would have just ended it, but they couldn't. There was not going to be a divorce in the Kennedy family. There had never been one, and there wasn't going to be one starting with JFK. It just wasn't going to happen. And Jackie did try to divorce him at one point and threatened to divorce him a couple times and might have gone through with it if she thought she would have been able to get past Joe Kennedy and the Kennedy machinery. But there was no way that they were going to allow that, you know, so she had to find other ways to cope with her marriage, and she did. And eventually, you know, they came together and they became a really close couple. But you see that this was not easy.
Do you, if you don't mind a tangent for a moment, Jay, Randy Tarbarelli, do you have a staff that works with you on your research?
I do. I have a staff. I can never do all of this on my own. It's just too many people. And, you know, I have one woman who's worked for me for 30 years. Her name is Kathy Griffin, not the comedian. and she will find the people. I mean, when I wanted to locate Janet DeRose, who was Joe Kennedy's secretary, who he hired when she was 24 years old, when I wanted to contact her children, because I wanted to get her story, and surely she has to be dead, right?
Yeah.
Kathy found her children, and she called me, and she said, "And guess what? I found her." And I'm like, but she's got to be 100 years old. And guess what? She was. She was 100 years old. And she was amazing as an interviewer, as an interview. And she really had a great memory, and she was just astonishing. And her story is told here for the first time. And her story basically is that she was not only hired as a surrogate, she was hired as, I mean, as a secretary, she was a surrogate wife to him, brought into the family to be with him emotionally and physically. And this was agreed to by Rose Kennedy. But bigger than that, she was a part of it. She didn't look at it as a cross to bear as much as she looked at it as a blessing that she was able to stay with this man that she really didn't love, and able to travel. Didn't have to worry about getting a divorce because she was Catholic, and what that wasn't going to happen. And Janet took the pressure off of her from having to be with him. And Rose was very, very grateful to Janet. And in the book, I tell this entire story, and there are letters from Rose to Janet, and you see that their relationship was a very close one. Well, of course, this is completely unconventional and absolutely insane. But this is true. And if you're raised in a family where that's going on, when your parents make that decision, then what kinds of decisions are you going to make in your own marriage, right? So when people say Jack Kennedy cheated on Jackie because Joe Kennedy cheated on Rose, and it was like father like son, I always thought that that was just too easy. And I found that that wasn't the entire story. It was also because of the mom. And not only because she accepted it, but because she orchestrated it, right? It wasn't like the long suffering. She wasn't suffering. It wasn't the long suffering wife accepting the infidelity of them. It was the happy wife able to get out of the house and travel and not have to worry about this guy, and knowing that the woman he was with is somebody that she liked. So we think if we apply, you know, normal standards to this, it sounds like the craziest thing ever. But if you're living that life, it's not. And Janet DeRose told me this story, and it was an incredible story. It's in the book for the first time. And you know what? When she left Joe Kennedy, she ended up working for JFK in the Oval Office. She was his first secretary when he became president. And a funny story is that they were on an airplane together, and Kennedy wrote a note and passed it to Janet. And the note said, "Don't you think it's time you were attracted to me?" Oh my God. And Janet wrote a note herself and passed it to him. And it said, "No." She wasn't going to have sex with the son after she was with the father for 10 years. Right. So it's a good story.
Yeah, very good. Well, Joseph P. Kennedy had already been kind of, I mean, I don't know what the relationship he had with Gloria Swanson was, but essentially they were lovers, and he was her producer in Hollywood, right? I mean, he helped her with her Hollywood career.
Well, yeah, I mean, and they were lovers. And, you know, again, Rose Kennedy was well aware of it. I mean, they had Gloria Swanson to the house, and she and Rose Kennedy got along great. Rose Kennedy writes about her in her book, Times to Remember. Mm. And she was a lovely woman, and we had her to the house, and we had dinner. And you know, look, this is a different world. I mean, today, a lot of women would not put up with this kind of stuff, you know. But my message is that the portrayal of these women as long-suffering wives tolerating their husband's infidelity is not the case. It wasn't the case with Rose, and it wasn't the case with Jackie. Jackie knew everything that was going on, just as Rose did. They made decisions, you know, to accept it for their own reasons, but they weren't tortured by it, you know. And you know, and I think that you really get a picture of Jackie as trying to navigate marriage to a very difficult man, whose parents had a marriage that was crackers, right? But she realized that he had a lot of growing up to do, and she stood by him as he grew up, and it was hard, but she did it.
Do you think, in your research, do you think there is any connection between the death of Marilyn Monroe and Robert or John Kennedy?
No, in all of my research, the Kennedys had nothing to do with that. You know, I think that if you understand, and I wrote about Marilyn, The Secret Life of Marilyn Monroe,
yeah,
and we did that as a Lifetime miniseries with Susan Sarandon. If you knew enough about Marilyn, you knew that she had 5 or 6 overdoses prior to the one that took her life. If it had been like a surprise, like, oh my God, Marilyn overdosed, what's that all about? That would be one thing, but she had overdosed so many times and was brought back from the brink of death so many times that this last time, I believe, was just a really bad night that had a terrible ending. And the Kennedys had nothing to do with that, you know? And as I write in the book, I don't believe that Marilyn and the Kennedys had anything to do with each other. You know, I think that Marilyn and Bobby had a friendship that did not turn sexual. And Marilyn and JFK didn't even have that. And I interviewed Pat Newcomb, who was 95 years old and who was Marilyn Monroe's best friend and publicist, who never gives interviews. And she talked to us and, you know, she was great. And she said, absolutely not. That didn't happen. If that happened, she said, I would have known it. That I was her best friend. And I was the publicist who would have been setting up those meetings. You know, she said it didn't happen. And I believed her. I really did.
Well, it's interesting how the rumors just continuously persist all these years later. But, you know, there are those conspiracy theorists out there. And that kind of all began, that whole – it's really interesting how conspiracy theories have changed. And they all really began with the Kennedy assassination, I think. And when the conspiracies about the Kennedy assassination began in the 1960s, they were mostly left-wing-led conspiracy theories. And now – it's the right wing that embrace conspiracy theories. You have any theories about how that changed over?
Well, you know, as I wrote in the book, the JFK murder is sort of like the greatest murder mystery of all time. And it's still not solved. Probably never will be solved. But there was a time when the left really wanted to know what happened. And then the right sort of came in with a lot of conspiracy theories and just kind of added Kennedy to the, you know, to the mix.
Yeah.
As being part of the deep state, right, you know, because really in a sense, it was because of the Kennedy assassination that people began to believe that something was going on with their government that they didn't know and they didn't understand. It was with the Kennedy assassination and the Warren Commission report, which many people did not believe, the commission that was charged with investigating the Kennedy assassination. Many people didn't believe it, and that was the first time people were like questioning the government and wondering what's being hidden, you know. And since that time, then after Watergate, that really exploded. You know, and so now there's this whole sort of movement of people who are looking for conspiracies and finding them, not just with the Kennedys, but with, you know, with all sorts of touchstone moments in our history. And I personally have never wanted to be one of those guys, because the guys who study the assassination, man, they're serious about it. And they can tell you the, you know, the trajectory of every bullet. And they've written entire books about it. And they're smart. And they're not, you know, I mean, they're formidable. And I never wanted to be on TV with these guys and me just being this sort of dumb guy in the corner with nothing to say, because I don't know about the trajectory of these bullets, right?
Yeah.
So I've always positioned myself as a guy who writes about his life, not his death. And if you look at the new JFK book, the assassination is about 5 sentences.
Right.
Like I got out of it with a paragraph, whereas other people will spend entire books on the assassination. I got out of it with a paragraph. And in Jackie, Public Private Secret, it's less than that. It might be three sentences. Because for me, there's not much more to say other than the fact that it happened.
Yeah.
I'm more interested in what happened after with the family. You know, I'm more interested in the fact that Aristotle Onassis was at the White House for the funeral of JFK. Mm-hmm. Right. What the heck is that about? That's what interests me more than, you know, the specific details of the murder.
Yeah. Well, I was also interested to learn in your book. I mean, I knew that President Kennedy suffered from a variety of ailments, but his health issues really date all the way back to his 20s.
Yeah, I mean, his health issues dated all the way back to when he was 3 years old, you know, and hospitalized with scarlet fever. He was sick a lot throughout his entire life. Operations, back operations. He almost died several times. He was on crutches in his 30s. You know, he struggled with chronic pain, Addison's disease, all kinds of things. I mean, the guy was really suffering. And to think that he was able to, you know, live the life that you need to live in order to be a president. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I've always thought that the infidelity was overblown. You know, Rose Kennedy says something in this book that's really funny. You know, she said, in talking about all the infidelities, somebody, I think it was a niece, asked her, "Do you believe all of the stories about Jack and all these women?" And she said, "How could he do all that and handle Khrushchev?" Right. Like, when was the time to do all that and deal with Khrushchev, you know, and which is really, look, when you're a president, you don't have a lot of time for the kinds of things that JFK was rumored to have been doing. I'm not saying he didn't do it more than other presidents did, but I am saying that I think a lot of it is blown out of proportion because not only was he president, but he was sick all the time. As well as being president, you know. So when was he sneaking off with these women, and how was he performing on all the medication that he was on? I just think that you really have to take a look at a lot of that with a grain of salt. And I decided when I started this book, I wasn't going to do a compendium of all JFK's alleged mistresses. I picked the few that I thought made a difference.
Mm-hmm.
There may be four in the book. Maybe three, you know, I'm not sure, but three or four, and then I'm out.
Well, what about his relationships with his parents and his brother? I thought those were interesting aspects of your book, but can you comment a little bit about that?
About his brother? About Bobby?
Or about just his family relationships. I mean, they're all so complex and interesting.
Very complex, you know. The mom was, you know, not affectionate, and she was cold. She tried to be a good mother, but it was hard for her. She wanted a different life. I think that women of her time weren't supposed to have dreams. They were just supposed to have husbands and children. And she had dreams. She wanted to travel and she wanted to live a bigger life than being saddled with 9 children in Hyannisport. And the father was a much better parent in many ways because he was there for his kids. And he did a lot of the wrong things, I think, but for the right reasons. And JFK and his father, you know, had a very close relationship. But, you know, there were issues there because JFK didn't want to be dominated by anybody. I mean, JFK had political skills from the time he was a young man. And when it came to confrontation with people, he was good at it. When it came to standing up for himself, when it came to pivoting, when it came to blaming, You know, he had all those political skills at an early age. That's kind of the stuff you need to be a good politician. You need to be able to pivot, place blame, you know, be unreasonable, right? All those things are important if you're being a politician, and JFK had them. And he learned a lot from his parents about how to navigate that world. When his brother Joe, who was going to be the first president in the family, when he was killed in the war, then it was up to JFK to be able to take that mantle on, and he did. And we see how that went, you know. But I also wanted to say in the book and make it clear, it wasn't like it was foisted upon him. He really wanted it. JFK wanted to be a public servant more than anything. And he wanted to serve his country more than anything, because he could have avoided the war just by virtue of all of the many illnesses he had. He could have gotten any number of different deferments. And he didn't want that. He actually circumvented his father to get into active duty. And he did get into it. And and that resulted in PT-109. And I wrote about that as well. And he became a war hero because of that. But he didn't have to serve. He just really wanted to.
Do you think he wrote his books that were published in his name?
I think he wrote some of them. Some of the book, you know. We're talking Profiles in Courage here.
Yes.
He was very, very sick during that time. He had just had a back operation, and he could barely function during the time that he was supposed to be writing Profiles in Courage. Uh-huh. And the story that's evolved since then is that Ted Sorensen wrote most of the book, but based on JFK's handwritten notes and outlines. And I have accessed all of JFK's handwritten notes and outlines on that book, and they're voluminous. I mean, and you can't even read them because the guy's handwriting is like, whoa. Right? So I don't know how Ted Sorensen even did this, because it's stacks of paper that you can't read, but written by JFK. And I think that Ted Sorensen took a look at this material, and he read it very carefully, and he knew his friend, and he knew JFK's language, and he was able to put this all together in a book. But to say that JFK sat there and typed out the book would be not true.
But it's based on his, and you've seen the writing, so based on his.
Yes, I have.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you, J. Randy Tarbarelli, you've written, I don't know, what number book is this? 27, 44, 52? How many books?
I really don't know. If this book becomes a bestseller, it will be my 20th bestseller.
Wow. Well,
and not every book I wrote was a bestseller, so I've written more than 20 books. That's the only way I can gauge it.
How did you get started? This kind of a novelist approach, I think, to your books. And I wonder, did you start thinking of yourself as a novelist, or always wanting to write biography, or how did you get going?
Well, you know, Jackie Kennedy gave me my start. Jacqueline Onassis. I was a newspaper reporter as a young guy in Los Angeles. I had written a series of articles about Diana Ross. She wanted Diana Ross to write her autobiography, and Diana didn't want to do it. And so, you know, Jackie contacted me, and I ended up doing it. And it was an amazing experience working with her. And so now when I write about her, I see her in my mind's eye in a way that maybe other people don't see her, because I actually remember sitting across from her and talking to her. And it has kept me on the straight and narrow in many ways, because I can't tell you how many times I've written something and thought to myself, what would she think of this? Hmm. You know, and how would she feel about this? And sometimes it's made me tweak it a little bit, you know, because it's given me a sensitivity to her and her family members that maybe other people might not have. And maybe that's not objective. I don't know. Who cares? I don't care about, you know, people say, well, that's not objective. I mean, I think that my books are a reflection of me and of my sensibility and what I think is fair and balanced. And I always say, just because something is true doesn't mean it deserves to be in a book. It needs to be more than true. You know, it needs to tell a bigger story, and it needs to be told in context. And there needs to be empathy applied to it, because it's such an important mission to tell these stories. And I don't take it lightly, you know. And so I guess, to answer your question, yeah, I mean, I believe in painting pictures, not just giving facts. I think the facts don't matter as much as the story matters. And then the story has the facts within them. Otherwise, I would just quote people. So-and-so said this, so-and-so said, but I don't do that. I actually will bring you into the story. And we can't do that unless our sources are really cooperative, and we drive them crazy. What did you say? What did you wear? What was she wearing? What time of the day was it? You know, what did you eat? I mean, I drove Janet DeRose, the woman that I talked to, mentioned earlier, who was 100. I drove her out of her mind trying to get her to remember what happened 65 years ago and what she was wearing when it happened. Right. But, well, but I'll tell you, the thing about it, man, is that these moments we're talking about, yeah, were big moments in these people's lives. Like, I don't remember what happened in third grade, but my third grade year wasn't spent with JFK. Right. You know, I mean, I think if you have a period of your life that was spent with Marilyn Monroe, like Pat Newcomb told me, she said, I don't really spend a lot of time thinking about what my friends were doing 65 years ago. But if your friend was Marilyn Monroe and she was having sex with the president, I think I'd remember.
Well, that's the I love the level of detail in your books, and it really, you know, the people you write about come alive on the page, and that's what makes your book so great. That the new book is called JFK, Public, Private, Secret. J. Randy Tarabarelli, thanks so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
I always enjoy talking to you. Thank you for having me, and I'll see you in 2 years.
All right. What will it be in 2 years?
I can't tell you, but I can tell you this. The saga continues.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf. And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.